Today is the 3rd of February 2015. I'm interviewing Bruce Jenkinson, formerly of the Hawke's Bay Farmers Meat Company, Wakatū, and he's going to give us a background to him and his family and his life in the meat industry. Where did your family come from originally?
They came from Yorkshire. Both my mother and father, though they came out to New Zealand separately as individuals, they knew each other in England. My father, my grandparents had a pub called the Black Horse.
Yes.
It was in a village called Giggleswick. And Giggleswick is in the West Riding of Yorkshire and Ribblesdale. Across the river was a town called Settle, which was a bit bigger than a village.
Sure.
Giggleswick was renowned for its public school, Giggleswick Grammar School. Founded in 1499.
Very old.
My father and the rest of his family went there. I don't know, they also had a farm. My mother's people were farming people too. They came from a place near Harrogate in Yorkshire, which was 30 or 40 miles from Giggleswick. My father's a very shy individual, rather like me, but he didn't tell us very much about himself and why he came to New Zealand. I don't know. Don't know. We had great difficulty after his death in finding out just when he came. Mm-hmm. He came shortly before the outbreak of the First World War. He immediately joined the army in New Zealand. And he actually served in the army for 7 years.
Yes.
He wasn't discharged till 1922.
Yeah.
And he was in the dental corps. He was in the hospital ship. Mahino. Since then, we've had a sort of military background. His younger brother was killed in the First World War. My eldest brother went missing on air operations in the Middle East. 1941. My son's an army officer. My eldest grandson just graduated from Duntroon and is also an army officer. Just come up here. Can you take that with you?
No.
I was going to show you some pictures.
I'll have a look at those later. Alright.
My mother came out here in 1915, I think.
Yes.
Just why, I'm not too sure. She had two brothers out here. She went initially to live with one of the brothers in Temuka, in the South Island. He was a florist nursery, name of Lewis. Was his surname. But then somehow she finished up in Wellington. And my father has a very good rugby player. He played for Yorkshire.
Yes.
He's also captain of the Harrogate Rugby Football Club for a number of years. And my mother's brother was also in the team, and that's how they met. So they met up again in New Zealand.
Well, that's amazing, isn't it?
And they were married on Armistice Day. Well, it wasn't really Armistice Day, I suppose. It was the 12th, the day after. But
sure.
That was when the news got here.
That's right.
You know, we're
yes.
The that's Saturday morning.
That's right, and yes.
That's when they were married. In 1918. as far as we can make out, came to Hastings in about 1925, according to my brother. But he doesn't really know much either. He was born in 1925. That's the surviving brother.
Yes.
Yes, he was born in 25. And I was born at the end of 1929. Went to kindergarten in Hastings. Kindergarten was in a building, I think it's still there, behind the old Baptist church, which has been demolished in Carrimer Road.
That's right.
Then I went to Central School. My father was on the school committee for 18 years.
Goodness me, yes.
And I went to Hastings Boys High School.
Yes.
Then I went to the UK when I left school. I was away for about a year. I went over. I went with a fellow called Bruce Comrie. You remember Dr. Comrie?
Yes, I do, yes.
And we were actually going to a scout thing in Norway, but that was only for a fortnight. And I stayed over there for about a year. I had lots of relatives.
Yes.
In Kigglesvik, settled in Bryn Harrigan. Lots of relatives. And I stayed mainly on my mother's eldest sisters and their farm.
Yes, yes.
At a place called Killingall. But I travelled about extensively in the UK. I bought a little motorbike. I travelled about quite a bit, visiting relatives and doing a bit of sightseeing. Particularly in Kigglesvik, where my father came from. The pub, the Black Horse, was right next to the churchyard where all the relations were buried.
Right, right.
And when I returned to New Zealand, it was about this time, 1950. That late January, early February, 1950.
Yes.
And it had been my intention to be a school teacher. But I became less keen on that as I got older. And you know how in those days, everybody you weren't educated if you hadn't had a season at the freezing rink.
Absolutely, that's right.
And I had to get some money from somewhere, you see. So I went to work at Tomona.
Right.
After a few months, two or three months, I was approached by management and asked if I would ever thought of a career in freezing rink management, you see.
Right.
I said, well, no, I hadn't. And they suggested that perhaps they could be looking for people like me.
Yes.
They might be interested. The family, Alec Kirkpatrick was manager.
Yes, yes, yes.
The family, two families were friends.
Sure.
Known each other for years.
Yes.
Alec Kirkpatrick was chairman of the Central School Committee while my father was secretary.
Right.
And he had a yarn with me. We also had a friend from the UK had been sent out here. He worked for Vectis.
Yes.
And he was sent out here, and he was in the wool side of the business, and I got very interested in that. So I went to Lincoln College, and Lincoln Agricultural College. And I did a course there in wool. And when I finished, I went to Wellington, had an interview with a fellow called John Coleman, who was the general manager of W&R Fletcher, who owned all the Vestey Works.
Yes.
And so I started working for Vestey's.
Right.
I was sent up to Westfield. And I was there a couple of years. And then they sent me to Patea and Taranaki. Yes. Terrible place.
Yes.
While I was in Taranaki, in Patea, I got appendicitis. Went into hospital, have it out. There's a little hospital in Patea.
Yes, yes.
That's where I met my wife.
Right.
She's a nursing sister there. In fact, all, with one exception, I think, there might have been two, the matron and one other, were the only ones that weren't immigrants.
Is that right?
They came out under the assisted passage scheme.
Yep, yep.
Of course, they had to go where they were told.
That's right, yes, yes.
And they couldn't get staff at Patea.
Yes.
So it was full of these people.
Yes, yes.
That's where I met my wife.
Well, during this period, prior to this, did you play any sports at all? Rugby or...?
I played rugby at school. I was in the first 15 for a couple of years.
Yes.
But I didn't play any sport after that until when I was at Westfield and told I was being transferred to Patea. I knew nothing about the place. But there was a fellow at Westfield who had been at Patea. He was the employment officer. I suppose you'd call him. He'd have some fancy title today.
Yes,
his name was Baxter. This is really another story, and I could talk about it for hours. he said to me, he said, if you drink, gamble, and play golf, he said, you'll be right in Patea. And I said, well, I don't do any of those things.
Right.
Oh, well, he said, it'll be interesting to see which ones you... So I said, after I'd been in Patea a few months, I started playing golf.
Right.
And I played golf for nearly 50 years. I'm still an honorary non-playing member of the Hastings Golf Club.
Right, right.
But all that's another story, though.
Sure, sure.
So I had a lot of connections in Hastings.
Yes, yes.
Knew a lot of people. A lot of people knew me. And one day, I can't remember exactly when, quite out of the blue, one evening, quite out of the blue, the phone rang. It was Ian Cameron, whom I knew. We'd been at school together.
Sure.
He was a class ahead of me.
Yes.
He was a bell ringer. He was a bell monitor.
Yes, yes.
He'd got me into Parkvale School. Anyhow, he said to me, are you interested in coming back to Hawke's Bay? I said, yes, I am. And he said, well, we have got something here that might interest you. He said, would you come across and have a yarn with him? I said, right, I said, I'll come across next. How about next Sunday morning? That'll be all right, 10 o'clock. At the office in Waikato.
So we came over on the Friday night, stage of appearance. Went out to Wakatoo at 10 o'clock next morning. The only person in the office was Cyril Cushing, who was the works manager.
We all knew Cyril Cushing, yes.
So I had a long yarn with Cyril. They were doing a bit of reorganisation at the upper level. They didn't say so, but it was obvious that Ian was groomed to go up. At that stage, he was assistant works manager.
Sure.
And they wanted somebody to take his place. So after some discussion, it was settled. I would come go to Wakatoo. It was decided that I would have to learn the Wakatoo culture.
Yes, yes.
And that I should spend some time, firstly, doing odd jobs around the place, just to get the feel of the place and settle in, sort of thing. When could I start? I said, I'll have to give notice at partying. That's right. They said, well, we want you to start before the season starts. I said, righto, I'll start round about Labour weekend. And he said, that's all right, we'll be fine. Well, there's another side to the story that, about all that, but it's nothing to do with
part of your life, though. Yeah. I think you should tell it.
Well, I've been trying to get out of Partier for some years. I got on very well with a manager, a chap called Ralph Potter. I'd known him at Westfield. Nice bloke. Did a good job at Partier. Good golfer, too. He was trying to get me moved on.
Yes.
And he was sent away to South America somewhere. He was away for about 3 months. And all this happened while he was away. And I knew that he was trying to get me a job elsewhere in the organisation. But I didn't push it, I did yield to him. One of my jobs at Partier was that Partier had a very extensive wholesale meat trade. They used to tender for the supply of meat to places like all the hospitals, New Plymouth, Harbour, Partier, Punstonwell, the military bases, Linton, Ahakia, Wairuru.
Right.
They had a place in Whanganui called Maokia. Maokia supplied the processed pork product. Mm. So, to keep this trade going, Partier had to work all the year round. So, of course, in the winter it was expensive to bring all the men in and work for perhaps to kill 200 sheep or something like that. Yeah. When they had to pay the minimum wage,
that's right. Mm.
Which was about the equivalent of about 35 hours a week.
Yes, yes.
So, one of my jobs was to augment the supply of skins to the fellmongery so that we could lift the payments up nearer the minimum or bring the cost down per skin. So once a month I would travel around the southern North Island and I would go to all these skin sales and I would buy skins at auctions for delivery to Frontier. You process them there try and keep the cost down. One of the sales was in Wanganui. And I used to get a ride to Wanganui with the in a wholesale meat truck about 5 o'clock in the morning. Go to Levin and Company. And you do a valuation and then they'd have the auction. And then of course I had to get back to Parkia, but I had to wait till the wholesale meat truck came back. And that might be 2-3 o'clock in the afternoon.
Yes, yes.
And I was walking down the street one day in Wanganui, waiting, because I didn't expect the truck for another hour. And I ran into Ralph Potter, the manager at Parkia. I don't know what he was doing in Wanganui. Oh, he said, I'm going back in a few minutes. He said, I'll give you a ride back. I said, okay. I said, well, I'll have to go round to Maokia and tell them so that the driver knows not to be waiting for me. So I did that. So we had quite a yarn going back to Parkia, and he told me then that he was trying to get me a job over here. At that stage, the Vesti organisation had a frozen vegetable business in Hastings and in Timaru, I think.
Yes, Fropac.
Fropac.
Yes, I know that. Yeah.
And they had a factory in Coventry Road.
That's right, yep.
I'm trying to think of the manager's name. Can't remember him. Anyhow, he told me that he was trying to get me in there as assistant manager, Fropac, you see. It wasn't all that keen, but this is what he was doing. At this stage, of course, this was prior to my getting the call.
Yes.
For me.
Yes.
And then Potter went overseas. And then all this happened, you see. And I had a lot of respect for Ralph Potter. And I thought, well, I'll carry on here. I won't say anything until Ralph comes back. And he was due back in about 3 weeks. And I thought, well, somehow I've got to sell my house. We built a little house.
Yes, yes.
And very difficult to sell houses in Parkia.
I can imagine.
There were no real estate agents.
No, that's
you
right.
Just sort of relied on word of mouth and what your solicitor could do for me. So I went to see my solicitor, who is also a personal friend, and told him what the story was, told him I wanted to keep it quiet, but, you know, my house was for sale. And if he knew of anybody. Anyhow, somehow, I don't know how to this day, it got out. Now, whether it was at this end or that end, I don't know, it got out. I often suspect my mother wagged her tongue a bit.
Yes.
When I came across for this interview with Cyril Quick, one of the questions he said, does your mother sing in St. Matthew's Choir? And I said, yeah. Oh! He did too.
Oh, right.
So maybe that's how I got the job. Yeah. Anyhow, a little while later, one morning, it was about 10 o'clock, the relieving manager, how was his name? The fellow from Westfield was sent down to relieve while Ralph Potter was away. Can't remember his name. He sent for me. So I had to see him and he said, your house is on the market. He said, are you leaving? And I thought, it was no good denying it.
That's right.
So I said, yeah, I said, I am. Well, I'm putting in resignation. I said, yeah, I was going to do that as soon as Ralph Potter came back. which I understand will be in about 3 weeks. That was right. About 2 o'clock that afternoon, he sent for me again. Oh, he said, I've been talking to Wellington. And at that stage, the general manager was overseas and there was somebody relieving there. Now, what was his name? He was the accountant who sort of took over when the general manager was away. Scott. Somebody Scott. Anyhow, this fellow part here, he said to me, oh, he says, Scott says you can finish. Go. But not back well if you got out. And so I walked out. That was it. Finish.
Good God.
Just like that. And I came home. My wife happened to be home. She was still working at that stage.
Yes.
I told her. She just laughed.
Oh,
so I rang Cyril Cushing.
Yes.
Told him I would start the day after Labor Day. I wanted a fortnight's holiday and had a few things to do and wind up. Then it all happened. We suddenly sold the house. My wife had a baby all at once. And we came over here.
Yes.
HVMC had a lot of houses in Wapiti.
Yes.
They'd set one aside for me.
Yes.
So that was wrong. The next month, I commuted back and forth. I used to come over here on a Sunday night, and I'd drive back prior to here. I came over here on a Friday night, and I'd drive back to Pāhatia on a Sunday night.
Yes.
At the end of the month, these people took possession. And funnily enough, I can't remember his name, who bought the boat, but he was from Hastings. And he was a hairdresser. I can't remember his name. And he bought a dairy, or taken the lease of a dairy. Yes. And he bought the house. Because there wasn't living accommodation with this dude. So, when he took possession, of course, we came over here and we moved into the house, property, Station Road, just opposite the hall. And I started work at Lockerton. The first job I got was I was told I had to work in the pay department the first 3 days of the week. I worked in the pay department. And the following 2 days, I followed that up by working in the costume department. This gave me a good background.
Yes.
But there are other things intervened. The rendering department foreman was a bit snowed under. He had no clerical assistance. He used to do all his own clerical work. And in those days, all what we call the technical tallows, that is those that we use for making soap and that sort of thing, the technical tallows were packed in 44-gallon drums.
Yes, yes.
Each drum was numbered,
yes.
Each drum was weighed, each drum had to be recorded in a big book.
Mm-hmm.
The edible tallows were packed in new wooden casks,
yes,
with a plastic line.
Yes, yes.
Same thing, they all had to be numbered,
yes,
and they all had to be weighed.
Mm.
So, for the first 2 hours every day, I got this job of going over to the rendering department and doing all the specifications for them, things, you see. And that enabled me to get a good background.
Yeah, right.
I didn't know much about rendering.
Yes.
And the foreman was a good bloke, nice bloke. I see him
usually at funerals. I saw him last week.
Yes, yes.
They may be of interest to you. I don't know. I'll tell you where he is. His name is Doug Lawrence, and he's at Princess Alexandra home in Napier.
Yes. Okay.
And he's got a very good practice. He'd only been in the job a brief time himself. And he had no background in wound. But at that stage, we were considering a lot of modernization and enlargement, that sort of thing, in the rendering department. And in the rendering department, there was a tremendous amount of very expensive machinery,
sure,
and a lot of pressure vessels.
Yes, yes.
So we decided that it would be better to get somebody with a mechanical engineering background. And we'd soon teach him that rendering.
Yes.
But we can... So he was a fitter at Wakatee. He was offered the job and he took it. He's a good bloke, nice bloke. So I went, I did that for some months. And I learned a lot about rendering at the same time. Then I got pushed on to another job. This is what happened. I got diverted on for this.
Sure, sure.
Now, there was a machine invented at Wakatee called a Spike Master. This machine eliminated a very messy, smelly process called pieing. Wool was saved from the trimmings off the skins, the cod and the brisket pieces, and the head piece. And in the old days, it was what we call pied. Yeah. It was literally left to rot, yeah, and then picked off by hand.
Yeah, sure.
We, when I say we, I wasn't there then, I mean the whole thing.
That's right. That was, yes.
What was the foreman's name at the time? I can't remember him. But he accidentally, I believe, discovered some other way of getting it off by heating the skin piece and having it pulled between two rollers, a big rubber roller and a metal roller. This machine was further developed by Borthwick's. Borthwick's had at their Wainaua works what they called a development section. I don't think they developed much. But they sort of took it over and they developed it a bit. Then it went to Nivens.
Yes.
Nivens and Nathan?
Yes, yes, yes.
And they developed it quite extensively. And they're building these machines. They were selling them around the world. We at Wakatee was getting a royalty. About the only works in New Zealand didn't have any was Wakatee.
Is that right?
Because I think we got such a good price for our pilot because it was recognised as being a good product.
It is.
Anyhow, it was decided that we would put these machines in. But nobody could have sort of quite knew where to put them or how to put them and set them up. So I got the job of doing that. I knew a little bit about them.
Yes, yes.
And I was given the boardroom to work in. And I had plans of buildings and slide rules and all sorts of things, and I used to make cut out little cardboard models of these things and try and shift them around and try and get them, because the way I wanted it wouldn't fit in the room because the the trusses for the roof were too close. And you, and it, the way I wanted to put the machines in was I wanted to extend them up in the air so we could get a conveyor underneath them to take the waste away.
Sure.
Other people would have a man there with a shovel and putting it into a wheelbarrow. Well, that was primitive.
That's right.
But to do this, of course, we had to lift them up, put the conveyor underneath, and have the crumbs tipping out into a container at the end of the conveyor. So, it was getting them to, it meant that they were going to be too high, and they couldn't get them all in. It was a bit of a problem. Could only get one between each truck, even though there was plenty of room. But there wasn't room for two.
Yes.
But somehow we managed it. And we got these things in. And we got them all set up. And we started production. Initially we had a lot of problems. I knew what the problem was. The chief engineer at the time was a chap called Eric Vickers. Eric was a very domineering sort of man. He had all the answers. And I kept telling him, I said, you haven't got the rollers tight enough. You have to have the rollers tighter than them between the two rollers. There's a big rubber roller, and then there was a smaller metal roller with a spiral cut into it that worked the pieces across.
Sure.
Oh, he said, the specification says that you've got to be able to get a cigarette paper between them. So here they were putting cigarette papers in. And I said, that's a lot of crap. I said, you've got to get that tighter. They've got to be tighter. No, you ruin the bearings. The bearings will be shot in no time. I couldn't make any progress with him. One day Cyril Cushing said to me, he said, I'm going to send Vic over to Timona to have a look at this float making. He says you're wrong. He said, they don't have to be tightened. They'll ruin the bearings. I said, yeah, he's told me. So I'll send him over to Timona. So he said, well, he said, don't go. He said, no, you stay here because I used to work there. So, Vic went over to Tamona. And I can remember to this day, sitting in Cyril's office with Cyril, when Vic came in back for Tamona. And the first thing Vic said was, oh, we haven't got the rollers tight enough. We've got to tighten them up. And I was just, and I opened my mouth to say something, and Cyril looked at me as if to say, shut up. And he gave me a bit of a wink and a grin. This is Vickers all over. Borrocks, mate. So, of course, they tightened them up. The things came right. We didn't have any bearings other than the normal run of things. You generally had to replace these things at the beginning of the season. You prevented the maintenance. You did that anyhow.
That's right.
Oh, God, I was mad. Bloody mad about that. I laugh about it now, of course.
And once they tightened them down, they worked beautifully.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And the way he's... Anyhow, I got jobs like this.
Yes, sir.
And after about 3 or 4 months, Cyril said, well, okay, he said, you're assistant works manager now, and that's it. Away you go, jobs. And the season was well underway, of course. And again, it seemed to be a troubleshooting job initially. We had a lot of trouble in the boning department. The foreman was hopeless.
I don't know where they got him from. But we asked him to leave eventually. And we had a lot of difficulty getting a replacement for him. But we did get a bloke, Jeff Holly. Great bloke. Good boner. Good leader of men. A great understanding with men and women, because we were getting women into those departments. I remember after Wakatura closed, Ethel Hutton from Waitaki was the sort of, well, he was acting as manager. I reported to him. And he came to me one day and he said, he said, he used to have a coal-fired locomotive at Wakatura. I said, yeah, that's right. I said, but it was before my time, but I can remember it as a kid, and that's all. And he said, what happened to it? I don't know why he's suddenly interested in it. I said, oh, it went up to the Museum of Transport and Technology in Auckland. But I said, I don't know under what circumstances. I said, it might have been on a sort of permanent loan business. And he said to me, well, find out, will you? I thought, what's he want to know about that for? But anyhow, that wasn't my problem. So I said to Ethel, I said, I'm sure, I know it went up there, and I feel sure that it would have been a board decision. And we have had that board approval. But he said, go through the minutes and find out.
Well, going through the board minutes, this is...
All right. He said, you know the approximate date? I said, yes. So I went through the board minutes for about 2 years around the date. And I couldn't find anything. But that's... The interesting thing I found was that in July... 1961, I think it was, the July meeting, Mr. E.B. Jenkinson of Pātia was appointed assistant works manager at a salary of £1,250 a year. The interesting thing was the salary, because that's not what I was getting at all. They were only paying me £1,050. I think that probably that was left for, bit rude to play.
Yeah, sure.
And I thought, And I always wondered, because when I got my first payment at Wakatū, it seemed an awful lot of money. And I went through it, and I thought, that doesn't work out. If I multiply that by 12, I don't get to $1,050 a year, which was the agreed payment. And funnily enough, the following month, down to the 1,050.
Is that right?
Yeah.
So did you ever, you never found out about the train, the engine?
No, never found out about it.
You don't know who gave it away?
I don't know who gave it away. I'm pretty sure that's where it went to. I don't know who gave it away. I don't know why Ethel Hutton wanted to know about it and why he was so pressing about it.
Maybe someone told him to go and play trains. So how many years were you assistant works manager then at Wakatū? From 1961.
About 10 years.
10 years.
Until Cyril retired.
Yes.
Because one of the things Cyril said to me when we were talking about the job when I came over for this interview, he said, if you make the grade, he said, works manager in 10 years' time. Mm-hmm. So he must have been 50, because we retired at 60.
Yes.
Had a very good superannuation scheme, Robert.
Yes.
Very good superannuation scheme. And, but he stayed on about another year
He'd have been about 61 when he retired, I think. He stayed on about another year after that. But they all sort of went pretty close together. Cyril Cushing, Ed Renniff, who was the secretary,
that's right, yeah.
And Dennis Little.
Yes.
So Dennis Little stayed on for another couple of years. He was a board member, and they kept him on for sort of a couple of years as a consultant or advisor while we were building that new freezer block.
Sure, sure.
Another thing at the time, we had this little house, this little cottage in Station Road, just opposite the hall. Of course, it started to look something more prim. Anyway, we finished up buying a section in Frimley, on the corner of off Lindhurst Road. I can't remember the name of the street. We bought this section in Frimley. It was very convenient because you just came down Lindhurst Road and Parkway Road. Anyhow, after I'd been there about 6 months or more, we bought the section, but we didn't have enough money to build a house. After it had been about 6 months ago, 6 months or so, Dennis Little, the manager and director, I think he was the general manager there, he said to me one day, he said, the board think that it would be a good thing if we had a senior executive living in Wapato. I said, yeah, I could agree with that. And he said, if we provided a suitable home, would you live in Wapato? I said, yeah. Do that. Two kids then. Manga Church, it was a good little school then.
That's
very
right.
Good school.
Yes.
So we're quite happy about that. So the hunt was on. Just down the road, and just down Anderson Road, there's a house that Ernie Anderson, old Ernie Anderson. The Andersons had the land down.
Yes, I know that. I know it all well.
And Ernie had built this place. It was only about 10 years old.
Yes.
And the fellow who was in it and owned it, he worked in the buyout. What was his name? Anyhow, it came up for sale. And Dennis said, well, go and have a look at it. So we went and had a look at it. I think there was 10 or 12 acres of land. It was down by the railway crossing on Stock Road by the casing factory.
I know exactly where it is.
And I said to Dennis, well, yeah, it looks all right, it's fine. I said, but I have to ask my wife what she thinks. Oh, it's fair enough. So we arranged for Margaret to have a look at it. She was quite happy. So the company bought it. I don't know what they paid for it. I pay £3 a week in rent. And we shifted in there. And we were very happy there. It was very good. Nice place. In those days, you couldn't get telephones. And they were trying to get a telephone for me. It was hopeless. Nothing. There were four lines into the office. At 5 o'clock at night, two lines were left in the office. One line was switched to the engine room, and one line was switched to the watchman's office. So what they did was they left one line into the office, and the other line that was into the office was switched to my house. So I had to give my wife instructions that, except an emergency, she couldn't use the phone between 7:30 in the morning and 5 o'clock at night. It wasn't listed in the paper. And that went on for years, until finally we got a phone, a separate phone. That's what it was like in those days.
I know.
Anyhow, we lived there for 12 years. And in the late 70s, there were a lot of major changes in the industry. What was became commonly known as the hygiene regulations. Now, most of the old freezers throughout the industry, the generally accepted storage level was about 12 degrees. Minus 12. I'm talking Celsius. Minus 12 degrees. But the MAF suddenly decreed that it be minus 18. This was as a result of demands from, principally from the USDA and the what we called the 3CVD. The 3CVD was the Third Country Veterinary Directive, and that came from Brussels for the EEC. Well, there were very, very few freezers in the country that would you could bring down to minus 18. There was a fund at Wakatu that we built recently for cartons, the new carton. And because once you tried to build them, bring them down, the insulation was insufficient. You got frosty, the ground underneath got frozen, and the floors got no. And so we decided that we had to totally rebuild our storage and freezing capacity.
Sure.
And the easiest way to do it was on a greenfield site away from the works.
Mm.
To try and do it and keep the works going.
Mm.
So we looked at this pretty carefully and we decided we could do this over the road, on the eastern side of the road. And we drew up some preliminary plans. We didn't own all the land, we owned most of it. We owned, of course, where my house was. Then there was an empty section next door going back towards the office. There was an empty section. And then there was a two-storied house that the company had bought, was built by some freezing worker. It was a pretty rough sort of thing, but the company bought it. They all were, when these things came up, they bought it. And then next to that, there was an old villa in which the railways fellow lived. What was his name? There were two railway men at Wakatu.
Mm.
One lived in this house.
Mm.
They had a little hut on the side of the track there.
Yes, yes, I remember that hut.
Mm.
Yes.
And they used to spend most of the winter sitting in it around a fire playing cards.
Yes.
Hay. His name was Hay.
Mm.
His wife was the postmistress, the post dot Wakatu. So we thought we had to do a lot of negotiating with the railways because we had to build over the railway line. We wanted to get that house, that section. We had a number of empty sections in Wakatu, and in particular we had one on the corner of Buckingham Street and Railway Road. And we offered to move the house onto that section, the railways, you think?
Mm.
And they accepted that. Mm. It was all part of the agreement. So that house was moved, and that left green fields, except for my place. And the fire station was at one end, but that fitted in reasonably well. And there was long debate about my house. They wanted me to stay in Wakatū, and I said, well, I was quite happy to do that. So they debated whether to move the house, but where to then, or to build a new one. Where, they weren't quite sure. Now, the next property down Anderson Road belonged to a fellow called Ozzie Wellwood.
Yes.
You know, yes. Right, right.
He was a drover.
That's right.
That's right.
I've just resigned from being a trustee of his estate.
Well, I've been glad. A lot of people wouldn't even know his name. Ozzie Wellwood, yep.
Well, Ozzie had 28 acres down there, and a little cottage, and a little barn, and a little set of yards. He was a bachelor. So, we thought, righto, we'll try and buy Ozzie out. He's getting on.
Yes, yes.
So they sent me down to talk to him. And I can remember one summer's lunchtime down there. We sat on his front doorstep in the sun shining at lunchtime and talked about it. And we offered him $36,000, I think it was. And the arrangement would be he would continue to live in the house as long as he wished. That by giving him 3 months' notice, we could take over bits of land as we required it for our purposes, because we needed some of it right away.
Sure.
Also, he could give us, I think, 6 months' notice for us to take over the lot. And that was all right. Ozzy's solicitor was Peter Gifford. So I obviously talked to Peter Gifford about it. And Peter Gifford came to see us, and we worked it all out, and the price went up to $40,000, and we did that. And the idea was then that part of it would be, with Ozzie's agreement, part of it would be fenced off, and they'd build a new house for me down there. So,
the house plans.
Good
Lord, good and bad.
And the re-siting of the house.
Yeah.
So, they called tenders, but they weren't very happy about the price.
Sure.
They called tenders for moving the house. And some house mover got the job. We lived in a motel at Karamu, you know, between St. George's Road and Farm Road, is it, or Farm Road? Is it?
Yes.
There's a little, there was a store there, and, and then motels.
That's right.
We lived there for about 8 weeks while all this went on. And one of the shipping companies lent us a big 40-foot container, and we parked that in the workshop. We put all our worldly possessions in that we didn't need at the motor. And they transferred, they shifted the house. It was a great job. I used to go down nearly every day and watch them. They took it down at about 5 o'clock one morning. And they took it down parallel. They had two trucks. And down the road, because it was a blind road then.
That's right.
It was gravel and there was no traffic there. That's right. Only Anderson's. And they took it down. Then there was a big ditch. And they had to fill all that with timber and stuff, dunnage, and then get across that. And then they did a great job. It was quite remarkable watching. And they did a great job restoring the house. They did some alterations. We did some extensions. And we were quite happy with that. They put the rent up too.
Yes.
And Ozzie was our neighbour.
Yes.
As he was a cantankerous old man, he had a few difficulties with him at times, but in general we got on pretty well. We took some more land nearer the works where we were building this new freezer block. We took some more land there to extend the railway line. Actually, we took far too much. That job was grossly overdone. I don't know how it came about. We overestimated it. But it was to our advantage. Because when the railways were looking for space to park their wagons not in use, well, we parked them at Wakatee.
Absolutely.
And when we wanted wagons, there was always one there.
That's right, yes.
So it worked out quite well, even though it was pretty costly. It cost us a bit of money and of capital in the first place. So it took a couple of years, perhaps. We built one store to start with. And it used to scare the wits out of me going into the old schools over the road, you know. And floors I don't know how the men went in there. I was pretty scared. And we hired an old furniture van from Barry Brothers. And we had that at the works all the time. And whenever there was a spare gang in the freezer, we load up this furniture van, take it over to the new store and unload it, so there was never a minute wasted getting stuff out of the old stores. Sure. One and two stores in the front weren't too bad. They had been refurbished in the 50s. But the other stores behind them, it really used to worry me when I went in. However, I have here amongst all this stuff a supplement to the newspaper for the opening of the I don't know the total details, but we came to an arrangement with Mackeson. They were to build the place on a basis, I think, of 10% profit. They provided the men and all that sort of thing. But we paid them.
Yes.
We paid the men.
Yes.
We paid for all the materials. Yep. We ordered all the materials.
Yes.
Probably if you talk to David, I don't know whether you want to know about that anyway.
No, it's all history. It's all part of it, yes.
We did the same thing at Tackenfown. But if you talk to David Campbell, who was the chief accountant, he'd tell you more of the details of it. But Mackesy did the job. And we could alter things as we went along. It wasn't like a contract.
No.
As though we were doing it ourselves.
Yeah, sure.
Now, up to that time, when we'd built the new access way at the back, we built the new boning floor, and that's another story, I can tell you that. We were probably the biggest construction company in Hawke's Bay.
Yes, yes.
With fitters, carpenters, plumbers, painters, electricians, literally hundreds of them.
Yes.
Because we did all these jobs ourselves.
Yes.
Because we could do it and fit it in with a kiln.
Sure.
Whereas you couldn't sort of do that with a contract.
No, you'd have to shut the works down, wouldn't you? Yeah.
But this was a sort of green fields job, and we could have done it ourselves, but they decided on this way. And we did, to some effect, do it ourselves.
Mm.
But it was Mackesy's men and we were paying them.
Mm.
And it was it worked out very well.
Mm.
Yeah, very well. And when we eventually built it, Tackbar, we did the same thing with Mackesy.
Mm.
And when did that open? I don't know, but that'll all be in here.
Yes, sure.
In one of them.
Right. Hmm? What was your kiln at that stage? Good God, look at that, will you?
Everybody on the plant got one of those on that day. And it had a pound note on it, I think, or after the...
Good Lord, look at that, will you?
Or after we changed to decimal currency, I think it had a $5 note or something. Now, there'll be... What was the date?
1967.
That was 67, and what was the QE?
That was 1.5 million.
1.5 million.
Yeah.
Now, it was later than that, so it'd be getting up around 2 million then. Every man on the place, every man and dog on the place got one of those. And I think, for 67, I think it was still pounds, shillings and pence then.
So how did your kill compare with Pomona's?
Well, that's another long story. I could go on for that about for hours. I wasn't intimately involved with the proceedings there, but I know a bit about them.
See, there's 2 million sheep and lambs, 1970.
Yeah.
God, that's incredible. Well, that's a lot of sheep.
As you know, probably, prior to this day, 85 years ago or 86 years ago, Borthwick's had a works at Pakipak.
Yes, yes.
On this day in 1931, it suffered severe damage.
Yes.
Discussions were then held with regard to the future of the industry in Hawke's Bay.
Mm.
And Borthwick's decided, which was a good thing for us, but not for them, I think they made the wrong decisions. Borthwick's decided that they would close the work, but they had to make some arrangements for their stock to be killed. Now, the Hawke's Bay Farmers Meat Company was a processing company. It didn't own anything. It processed and charged a fee for doing that. And it processed for many different meat exporters. So, it was arranged that we'd kill all Borthwick stock in Hawke's Bay. And that was from Woodville to the Mohawker, back to the ranges. But we couldn't do it. We didn't have the capacity. So we had to farm some out to Tomona. When I say we, this is way before my time.
History, yes.
Had to be farmed out to Tomona. Probably David Gascott could tell you something about it. I don't know. And this agreement was reached. And Borthwick's weren't allowed to take any stock out of Hawke's Bay. Had to be killed at Wagatu. Or Tomona, if we couldn't handle it. And at the end of the year, the season, they balanced up, and a payment was made between the two companies. Initially, the payment was made to Rockatoo. But after a few years, it was the other way around. And for years and years and years and years, we were paying Tomona a tremendous amount of money every year for this arrangement. And Tomona was sort of, appeared to me anyhow, to be sitting back and doing nothing much about it. Well, we were increasing the kill all the time. We had a huge, we finished, that was why they closed Rockatoo. We had a huge catchment area. We were getting stock from, well, you know, we took over the gear route.
That's right.
Then Wainawa closed, and we got stock from the Wairarapa, and stock right across from Whanganui, Tamarindui in the King Country. Right up, we got stock from the Waikato. Huge! And people saw this as illogical. And stock was brought to Wakatu and passed two or three other works on the way. But they wanted it killed at Wakatu. Our killing rates were cheaper than the other people's, and we were generally more efficient. And so this agreement went on for years and years and years. And at one stage, over 50% of our kill was Borthwick's. The Hawke's Bay Farmers Co-op had quite a big kill, but they transferred it all to Borthwick's. They had some arrangement with Borthwick, and they transferred it at the scales. So it came into the works as HBF, but after the scales it changed to Borthwick's. And that's another story we can come back on. But this agreement, which I'm not all familiar with the details, this agreement became a bit contentious, and it would be in the 70s sometime when discussions started to alter it. And I don't, there are a number of reasons for getting it altered, not at the cost of Rocker 2, but the fact that we were drawing stock from outside of our district. And
sure.
And not only that, at that particular time, now Dennis Little was still there, it was before Cameron's time, so it must have been in the early 70s. Anyhow, I said to Dennis one day, you know, we processed for all these operators, and all the product was kept separate. Orthrix was separate, had a different bag on it, and this was done at tremendous cost. We required a lot of storage space to keep all these things separate.
Yes.
And I said to Dennis Little one day, he was in the office, I said, you know, I've been down at Alliance, and Alliance operated on for much the same basis, but not quite. And one of the things at Alliance was, although the product was kept separate in the books, it was all packed in a common shirt, common bag, and it was all in one big heap in the store. And I said to Dennis one day, I think the time is coming when we've got to change this. Too costly. And I said, perhaps we could start with the ewes. If we put all the ewes in the common bag. And he agreed, much to my surprise, because this was one of the basic philosophies at Rocker 2, that the product belonged to the person who was killing it.
That's right.
Whether it be own account or an exporter. And that it remained that way, right through to shipment and so on, you see. And Dennis said to me, he said, you write to all the exporters and tell them that as from next season, all the ewes will be in a common bag. And you explain that. Okay, so I did that. Well, after that, it was out of my hands, I don't know. But as I understand that the only people that complained were Borthwick. And this, of course, precipitated the revising the getting into this agreement. And I can remember, it must have been in the 70s, because I can remember they used to have meetings at Rocker 2 on a Sunday afternoon. And there'd be Dennis Little and Sir Lanigan, the chairman, and perhaps some other board member. And from Tomona there'd be Alec Kirkpatrick and Wally Knight, who was then sort of being eased into the job as Kirk was going to retire.
Yes, yes.
He was pretty useless anyhow. Anyhow, he didn't stay long. He didn't stay long in Wellington. They sent him off to Wellington as National Livestock Manager. Anyhow, these discussions went on for some weeks, and the agreement was changed, but to what, I don't know. It was wasn't in my field.
Yeah, sure, sure.
So that was, we never changed it to anything else. We never changed the lamb or the beef. The beef went into their carton, the lamb went into their bag.
Sure.
It's just the ewes. And about, it's getting on to the 80s. No, it must have been the mid-70s. Ethel Hutton arrived as manager designate at Hawke's Bay Farmers Club. Ethel had been a stock agent for a firm in Gisborne. What was their name? It was just a private little
fizzling show.
I can't remember his name. But then he went into management of the show. Then the Hawke's Bay Farmers Co-op got an interest in it. And in fact, I think whether they got a controlling interest or not, I don't know. But then Jock Barlow, remember Jock,
yes,
Jock
yes.
Barlow was the manager
at Hawke's Bay Farmers.
He got in for SEMA.
That's right.
He was getting near retirement. And Ethel came, and Ethel eventually took over the job. The first thing that Ethel did, one of the first things she did, not as far as we're concerned, was that he started looking into this business with Borthwick's.
Mm.
Well, the Hawke's Bay Farmers Co-op had no infrastructure for handling all this. They had stock agents.
Mm, sure.
You could probably act as stock pickers. But they had no... they knew nothing about them. And Ethel came to the Hawke's Bay Farmers Meat Company and told them that they were going to stop giving their stock to Borthwick's and it would be theirs. Now this involved a lot of work for us, setting up a new exporter. It was quite a big job. And of course it fell on my shoulders.
Yeah, sure.
But anyhow, Ethel and I worked pretty well together and we got it all organised. And they got a bloke from, I think he'd been a shipping clerk, it's up in Gisborne. Reese Hopkinson was his name. Do you remember?
No.
I don't know what happened to him. He became the sort of meat man, marketing man. Now, I got on very well with him, but I did an awful lot of work for them for the first 2 or 3 years because really they were babes in the woods, you know, they didn't really have a clue.
Sure.
So they became an exporter in their own right.
Mm.
And Ethel told me, the first year they made $500,000 profit. And he was over the... Well, Ethel, of course, was over the moon. And, of course, this was a big beast to him.
Oh, yes.
And I always remember when Wakatū closed. Ethel is manager of Waitaki. We reported to him.
Yes, sir.
And one of the first things that... we did was that Ethel came round and he had a yarn with all the senior people, you see, for those who were left of us, some were already gone. And he said to me, he said, I want you to stay on a 3-monthly basis. He said, it could be up to a year before this all settles down. And he said to me, he said, I've never forgotten, he said, how good you were and what help you were to us when we took over our own stock at Hawke's Bay Farmers Co-op. And he gave me a $2,000 a year rise on the spot like that.
Good.
Which was good.
Oh, absolutely.
Because this affected my superannuation, it affected my redundancy.
Yes.
It was worth thousands.
Yes.
So Ethel wasn't such a bad joke.
No,
So that's what happened there. And now where do we go to from here? I don't know.
Well, you're in the 70s and you built the new store. Everything's running quite well. But at some stage or rather, the works was going to close.
Yeah, well, this was... there was all this talk about rationalisation.
Yes.
In the early 80s, as a result of what they called SMPs, or supplementary minimum prices,
yes,
there was gross overproduction.
Mm.
Gross overproduction. The land kill got up to 40 million.
I know, yes.
And a lot of the works couldn't handle it. That's one reason why we got so much stock.
Mm.
The meat producers bought at one stage. They thought they had all the answers and they took over all the land kill. But they finished up rendering a lot of them.
Yeah.
Carcasses. They all went to renderers. They had us rendering thousands of carcasses.
Good job.
And as this continued talk about rationalisation, the Labour government came in and they cut all the subsidies, and it looked pretty grim for the farmer, and the kill started to drop.
Yes, yes.
And it was getting to the stage, instead of a shortage of killing space, it was excess. I think too, the unions were waking up to the fact that you know, if they didn't pull the finger out, a lot of them were going to lose their jobs. And they, of course, they did. And there was a lot of discussion about how the industry would go about this rationalisation. They had some advisors or consultants who came up with grand schemes, but it was eventually they had decided amongst themselves that it was better to close one big works, so that it was settled on Wakatoon.
They recommended that, did they?
Yeah.
Well,
there was a firm in Wellington called Southpac. Just by knocking out Wakatoo, you knocked out a kill of over 2 million a year, plus about 120,000 head of cattle. But I don't know the details, and I may be maligning some people, or I don't know, but I believe that Selwyn Cushing got word of what was going on. You know, Selwyn had been financial advisor to the Hawke's Bay Farmers Meat Company. He was a director of Williams and Kettle. In fact, he owned a lot.
That's right.
So he knew a lot about what was going on. He had been involved in this business where Wakatoo took a quarter share in Williams and Kettle, and Williams and Kettle took a quarter share in Wakatoo. The idea being that it was going to prevent this sort of thing happening, but it didn't. It saw the demise of both, in effect.
That's right.
And I believe he got word of what was going on, he knew something about it, and he stepped into the market and started buying a lot of shares in Wakatoo. And that meant that they had to move fast and raise the flag. I think he made a lot of money out of the closure of Wakatoo. But I'm not sure, because I don't like to malign him, because I've always regarded him as a friend.
Yes, yes.
And he always has been. Because in the meantime, back in the 70s, the idea came out that we would build another route. That it was, the economies of scale weren't that great. We didn't want to extend Wakatoo, but there was stock available. We could get a stock. So in principle, we decided that build another works. I had some reservations about it. At that stage, the Wellington Meat Export Company had closed their Nowrong works. They also owned the works at Wairoa.
Yes.
My suggestion was we bought the works at Wairoa. But that was turned out. Didn't venture out. No, we built a new route. And Ian was real driver of it. I think it was his idea, and he drove it along. So we did. And of course, at that stage, the industry was licensed. You had to get a license to do anything. And they had these hearings in Wellington. The Nordmeyer, under Nordmeyer.
Yes.
And there was a lot of skullduggery went on. We had bought the gear meat processing. We ran it for a couple of years and then closed it down. It was obvious that it was, well, it was in the wrong place anyhow.
Sure, sure.
And so there was little stock available from there. They had these hearings. In the meantime, we looked for suitable properties. We decided that preferably would be within an hour's drive of Whakatū. The idea was that it would be run from Whakatū, it would be a satellite.
Sure, sure.
Wouldn't have any infrastructure of its own. Mm. Everything done from Whakatū. We decided we wanted no more than about 40 miles away. Because in those days there was a restriction on transport.
Yeah.
You had to get a license, special license.
If
you wanted to go more than 40 miles.
That's right.
Otherwise you had to use the railway.
That's right.
We were going to put rail in anyhow, but we wanted this.
Mm.
We wanted it less than the 40 miles that we could get them. So we whittled it. We looked at about 20 odd properties between Pakipak and Woodville.
Yes.
And finally settled on two, one of which was in the 40k zone, one outside. They were both owned by trustee companies, or both managed by trust, Guardian Executive Trust.
Yes, it is.
One was the Takapau property where it ventured on.
Yes.
The other was a ring, their ringy.
Yes.
We got options on both properties while we went into the nitty-gritty of which one.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of factors involved.
Sure.
Drainage, sewage and water and all the sort of thing. Power and rail connection. Finally we decided that it would be Kakapau.
Mm.
So we exercised our option and we bought the place. I don't remember, I think we paid about $330,000 for it and we let the other place go.
Mm.
Immediately, Pacific Low Richmond,
yep.
They immediately bought the property.
Yep.
We'd done all the work.
Yep.
They bought it with the intention. But of course, at that stage too, they had to get a license. We had this hearing in Wellington. I went to a couple of the sessions. Never been so bored in all my life. And all of what was said never came to pass. It was all wrong.
Yes, yes.
I had a bit of time on my hands in the last year at Whakatū. And all the submissions made to these committee were printed. So I took the opportunity of reading them. And yeah, I had to laugh at some of them. None of it was just a load of rubbish. Just a load of rubbish.
By people who knew nothing about it.
Exactly.
Yes.
People who just didn't have a clue.
Yes.
Anyhow, we then set about trying to get the license. They wouldn't give us a license for three chain work. They wouldn't give us a license at all, initially. And then we tried again. And we closed gear. And we proposed we would build two chains at Takapau. In actual fact, we would make provision for three. But we applied for a license for two, one of which would be transferred from
here.
Here.
Mm.
And that was accepted. But we no sooner got, we planned to build over about a year on the same basis as we built this freezer, the arrangement with Mackeson. We'd been on the job about a year and things were coming along quietly. And all of a sudden, the meat producers board or the government, they dropped the licensing. So of course, Pacific immediately started to build with their corrugated iron and four by twos at a ring. And in actual fact, they opened about only 5 or 6 months after it, but they had a lot of trouble.
Mm.
They had an awful lot of trouble, both mechanically and industrially.
Mm.
While we went out in three street.
Yeah.
Three street. So that's what happened there. But the big thing that really altered the industry was shifting it. Now, for years and years and years, we tried to get shift work in the industry, but the union that pays, the union. And initially they got a breakthrough in a small works at Ashford. I can't remember the people who started it up. He was some newcomer to the industry and he thought he knew everything. And he actually finished up in jail. I can't think who he, what it was now. But at least he got this breakthrough. And do you know, it was after Whakatū closed. And they started a shift worker to take a pen. Now, instead of killing 40 hours a week and the plant lying idle for the rest of the time, they were working 2 10-hour shifts a day. And each shift did 4 days. 4 10-hours, 40 hours. So they got a 3-day break. And I can remember in some work I was doing for the industry after my Whakatū friend being at Takapau, and these freezing workers telling me what a wonderful thing that, you know, you should have done this years ago. I said, yeah, we should have done it. You were the people that stopped it.
That's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, it was a wonderful thing. 3 days off and, you know, 10 hours a day, no trouble at all.
Yes.
40 hours a week.
Yes.
Ah, God.
So, Bruce, with the closing of Whakatū, was there a reason to close it? Could it have been done differently? Or was it inevitable with de-licensing? Would it have eventually gone?
Well, it certainly wouldn't have continued to exist in its form at the time. But I think it could well if it continued. The infrastructure was there. Could have worked shifts. I think they closed the wrong works. They spent about $40 million at Tomona and lost a lot because I think they made a terrible balls up of what they did. I'd like to have a discussion one day like this,
yes,
but with David Gascoigne.
Yes. It would be very interesting.
Yeah.
See, I interviewed Michael Sanders.
Oh, yeah, even with Michael. Oh, Michael's up in Auckland.
Yes, well, he's coming down again sometime this month.
Oh, I'd like to see him.
And he spoke for a couple of hours about Tomona.
Yeah.
And it was fascinating because he was there during the big fire. And, well, if he comes, I'll tell him to come and see you.
Well, so after the fire, because Tomona had the abattoir license.
That's right.
And they had it for both Hastings and Napier at that stage. The old abattoir on the beach at Awatoto.
That's right, yep.
Okay. And after the fire, we made hurried arrangements to take over the abattoir kiln.
Yes.
I remember we had to bring into use a couple of chillers that hadn't been used for about 20 years. They were the old chilled beef tray.
That's right, yes.
So that we could load out.
Yes.
We also arranged a kill stop for Tomona. For W and R Fletcher.
Yes.
Or for Vestes.
Yes.
And we managed all right.
Yes.
We got along fine. We managed all that in the abattoir kiln. And I can't remember exactly when that was now. In the 70s. In the 70s.
Now, Bruce, you said you were overseas when Whakatū closed.
Yeah.
You heard through the back door, sort of.
I heard through the back door. I had no idea. It never occurred to me that Whakatū would close. A new process had come into being in which it was said that chilled lamb could be processed. The process meant that it should be possible to send lamb to Europe by sea, a 28-day, 30-day voyage.
Yeah.
It was a process that It's called gas flushing. It's probably been refined a lot now. I mean, this is a lot.
Yeah, sure.
And I can't remember exactly the technical details of them. But we carried out some trials at Wakatu, and we ate some meat here that had been just lying in the refrigerator for 16 weeks.
Yeah.
Chilled.
Yeah.
No problem. Our agents in Germany, they're based in Cologne. Gedelfi, a firm called Gedelfi. They got interested in it. We were shipping quite a bit of lamb to Germany. They came up with all sorts of ideas, and they got keen on this. And they wanted us to have a go at it. So we did. We said, righto, we'll arrange for a shipment. Full container, they cut whole carcasses, cut though, but in natural proportion to their specifications. So we did this. And we arranged for some coverage with the Meat Research Institute. They were interested too in what was going on. They lent us a whole lot of recording thermometers. And we were able to pack these in various cartons and distribute them throughout the container so that we could get a broad
picture,
coverage of what was in the container, the temperatures in the container. I can't remember the name of the vessel. I know it was going to Flushing. And then the container would be offloaded to road and go to Cologne. So I went over there to follow it through.
Sure.
I waited about a fortnight or so after the ship had left here and went off to London. We had an office in London. When I say we, it was an associate, it's called Associated New Zealand Farmers. It was a combination of ourselves, Alliance and AFCO.
Yes.
And we had a cutting plant at Luton. We had our wool distribution place in Bradford. And they handled all our product that went to the UK.
Sure.
We had about four or five stands at Swiftfield. That's very interesting.
Yes, I bet.
Anyhow, that's not part of this particular story. So, spent a few days in London with Associated New Zealand Farmers, waiting for word of the vessel arriving at Flushing. Got word that I'd be there the next day. So flew over to Cologne. The container duly arrived. We unloaded it. The people at Gedelfi were very excited about it all. We had a plan of where all these thermometers were. Was able to retrieve them.
Yeah, sure.
About a dozen of them. And they had already made arrangements, that's sold it all, subject to it being up to scratch. About half the container went down to Stuttgart. So went down to Stuttgart, went to a restaurant and had some of it. It was beautiful. Funny thing, you know. We always used to pack our chilled product in white cartons. Keep chilled. Gedelfi, our agents in Germany, they wanted to change to black cartons. And I said, black, dismal colour. And they wanted little cartons, much smaller, half the size of this one, which put the cost up. Explained all this to them. No, they want, that's what they wanted, only the customer. And but black. And they said to me, I've never thought of it before. And they said, black, he said. We were at a flash restaurant. He said, "You see that waiter?" I said, "Yeah." "What colour clothes are you wearing?" "Black." "You go to a symphony concert?"
Black.
"No." "Quality."
"That's right."
"It exudes quality."
"Yeah. Yeah.
And my word, you know, at this restaurant, the service was just wonderful. And they weren't obsequious, they weren't, you know, laying it on.
Yeah, sure.
They were so professional.
Yeah.
I've never struck anything about it. And still in Stuttgart. And anyhow, I think we about half a container in this Stuttgart. Some went to restaurants in Cologne, some went to supermarket in Aix-la-Chapelle, in Aachen. And we went up to Aachen, which was north of Cologne, and we watched it being sold in the supermarket, people buying. Do you know, we never thought of it, but about this time, they had no word in Germany for lamb. They didn't know what to call it. And I think it was AFCO who came up with the idea, and they invented it, this word, L-A-M-M. And that's became the accepted...
Really?
Yeah. New Zealand L-A-M-M. New Zealand lamb. And that was what was on the card,
yes,
but at this stage it was still white.
Yes.
But I'd taken in the, about the black one.
No.
Okay, well, I spent a couple of, 2 or 3 days in Cologne. And then I flew across to Edinburgh. My wife came from up there, and she had a lot of relatives up there. So I went up to there for the weekend, to see her for a relative. And then I took a train back to London. I was in contact pretty regularly with Ian Cameron. And he never said him from France. But he said, I told him I'd been to Cologne. I said, it was great. He said, it's been accepted. I said, you know, we're on a winner here. This, And he said, what are you going to do now? I said, well, I want to spend a day or two at Luton. That's where we had this cutting. There's a lot of problems. And I said, I'll come home. But I said, I want to go to Tahiti. I said, we had... For years and years and years, every week, we had sent chilled meat to Tahiti by air. We had sent it to a restaurant and a hotel. We used to send lamb legs and lamb loins chilled, and we used to send beef tenderloins and strip loins. We'd done it for years. Nobody ever had any contact with him. Just as all telex, letter. And I thought, this is an opportunity. I'll go and call and see them. And Ian said, oh, he said, you can forget about that. He said, things are moving pretty fast here. You better come home. And I thought, he said, all right. And he says, I'll come home. I'll come home. I said, I have a weekend in Honolulu. So I said, I'll be in the office on Tuesday afternoon next. So I flew to Hans direct, well, Los Angeles, Honolulu, so direct state. Well, we stopped at Honolulu, but it went right through.
Yeah.
We stopped in Los Angeles, it went right through to Honolulu. The next Saturday morning, I was walking down the street, can't remember its name, by what they call the International Market. Do you know Honolulu, Waikiki?
No.
And I ran into a bloke called Glyn Grigg. And I'd known him for years. He'd been at Westfield when I was there. In fact, he died about a month ago. I saw a death notice in the paper. And I ran into him. And at that stage, I think he was working for Borthwick's in New York. And Borthwick's had left New Zealand, but they still had he said to me, "What are you going to do now?" I said, "Oh, I'm going back to Rockdale." "Well, but," he said, "Rockdale closed." And I thought he meant closed for the season. I said, "Yeah, of course it's closed for the season." I said, "We won't open up for another fortnight or so, yeah?" "No, no, he's just closed down." I said, "Oh." It just went over my head. I went back to the hotel for lunch, and when I went to the room, the little red light on the telephone wasn't. So I rang reception and said the little red light was on. And they said, "A Mr. Cameron from New Zealand has been trying to get hold of you. Will you ring him?" So I looked at my, I always carried with me a little thing that you, little cardboard thing that you turned around, told you what the time was, all around the world. And I reckon it was Sunday night. And so, Sunday afternoon. So I rang, but I got no reply. I thought he'd be at home. I rang home, not no reply. So I waited for about an hour, and I rang again. I got no reply. And I thought, well, sometimes he goes to work on a Sunday. Maybe he is at work. So I rang the office. I got the watchman. The watchman said, "Oh," he said, "there's a big meeting in the boardroom. We're all over in the boardroom," he said. "I'll put you through." I said, "Right, eh?" So he put me through to the boardroom. And Ian told me then that Rockatoo was closed. But they're putting people off right, left and centre, even on the Friday. You know, it closed. When they came to work on Friday morning, they found it was place closed up. So I said, "Oh, you're all right." I said, "It just went over my head. I was looking to see." And I said, "I will be back about lunchtime on Tuesday, your time." So I said, "I'll be in there for Tuesday afternoon." And Ian said, "Oh," he said, "your wife knows." He said, "I've rung Margaret and told her what the story is." And okay. So that was it. And Margaret met me at the airport and told me, and she had Saturday's newspaper there, Monday's newspaper there. And I went to work in the afternoon, but nobody was interested in me or what we'd been doing. The atmosphere was, how can I describe it? Some people weren't worried at all, others were quite worried about it. I don't quite know how to describe it. It was quite a calm sort of atmosphere. And Ian said, "Ethel Hutton will be coming to see you in a few days' time, you know, about your future." He said, "But I'll be finishing next week." And a lot of the people were finishing then and there. So that was that. And people just weren't interested in what I'd been doing or anything. Mm-hmm. Couldn't have cared less. Mm-hmm. It's just the way it was.
Yes.
And Ethel came a week or so later, and he offered me a job for 3 months on a rollover basis for probably up to a year. Mm-hmm. That's what happened.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was that, and people left like flies. In fact, it got very difficult. We had to encourage some people to come back because we couldn't. You see, we still had to run Takapau.
That's right.
We still had to book all the stock in for Takapau. Mm. We still had to pay Takapau. Mm. We still had to keep all the records and everything else. And all that still had to be done. We still had store for the meat to sell. Mm.
So when did Takapau close then?
Well, it didn't.
It's still going?
Yeah.
Is it owned by the Hawke's Bay Farmers Meat Company?
No. As part of the deal,
uh-huh.
as part of the deal, and it took a year to settle, Timona got Whakatū. Richmond's got Takapau. Then, of course, PPCS, what do they call themselves now? Silverfern Farm.
Yeah.
They took over Richmond's, and of course they operate Takapau, and they operate Pacific. Well, it was a fairly quiet sort of year. It was, they say Athol came and he was nominally running the place, and he'd come up from Christchurch about once a month or something like that, or, and we were always in communication with him. And as I say, Takapau still had to be kept going. We had a lot of product in store that had to be shipped. We had the accounts to do for the previous year, actually.
Yes.
That wasn't in my field. And we were desperately short of staff. Because people would say to me, well, you know, I've been offered a job, I said, we'll take it. Mm. Don't we worry about the Hawke's Bay Farmers Meat Company.
Mm.
And, let's take it. So away they'd go. We approached one or two people that had left us to come back, and they did. Two or three people. They came back to help us out. People with experience. I mean, you could get people, but it was much better if you had the ones that had, with experience and knew what was
absolutely
what the setup was and had been there before. So, that's what happened. And 3 months would go by, and I was offered a job in London. To turn down, I didn't want to leave Hawke's Bay.
No.
So I offered a job in Brunei.
Mm.
I'd had a lot to do with the halal slaughter business.
Mm.
I'd been on the New Zealand committee that
yes.
you know, worked on it, and travelled up to the Middle East to iron out problems and things and halal slaughter. And I was approached about this job in Brunei, and most of the kill was goats, but it was all halal.
Mm.
But I the meat producers bought off from their job, and they said, you can live in Hawke's Bay, come down during the week and go home again, we'll supply with a car. Mm-hmm. No wonder I can't understand these firms, so throw the money around and things like that. But then he had the map. I wouldn't have trouble. And so it went on, and we just kept going until finally, and I can't remember how we were told, I think Athol came to see us and said, 30th September is the deadline. And that's it, away you go. So we duly had a enclosure on the 30th of September 1987, lowering the flag, you see.
Yes.
Goodness me. These people got dressed up and so they thought they were the undertakers, some of them.
Oh, goodness me.
I don't know where a lot of these, as far as Brian Isherwood, he's the company secretary. I don't know what happened to him. He went to Wellington somewhere, I think.
Mm.
And we're lowering the flag, you see. tying up the
halyard.
The halyard. Anyhow, it was all. We had a big luncheon in the cafeteria. Everybody that was left on the works came to a big lunch.
Was Snow Bowes the caterer at Whakatū?
Yeah, but he's gone now.
I know.
He's gone by then.
Yes.
He'd gone to Wichmans.
Oh, yes. Because he was the caterer for our Rotary Club in Havelock.
Oh, yeah.
And he used to cater for us the same as he would have catered at Whakatū.
Yeah.
Lots of greasy meals and...
He was the caterer. Not at the office.
No.
At the camp.
At the camp, that's right.
And for anything big that we had, which wasn't that often.
And so when you lowered the flag and had your last luncheon there, that was it, you
just walked out.
Walked away. Mm. And as if it
just happened.
Yes, because lots of us, I went to Napier Boys High,
mm-hmm.
and every day I went on the bus past Whakatū,
oh, yeah.
and half the people on the school bus were from Whakatū,
yeah.
all these Maori families, and when it closed, couldn't believe that this huge behemoth could close.
Yeah.
And so then you came to retire seemingly at Undercliff, and you've been here for 30 years.
Yeah.
Now, you mentioned that your family, you have a son that's in the army, a daughter who's a lecturer, a PhD lecturer at Massey, and your family have had a lot of military spread through it, hasn't it?
Mm.
Were you ever in the... No.
I was called up.
Yes.
National Military Service, whatever. No, what was it?
CMT.
And I called up. I had a medical exam. And then I got a letter to say that I was posted to the reserve and that I was obliged under section so-and-so, blah, 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 to advise any change of address or marital status or occupation. I never done anything about it, never told them that. Never heard anything more.
Well, I was the same. I did my CMT and some of the, couple of weeks that we had afterwards. And then they sent me a note to say I was on the reserve list. And all the same things you said.
Yeah.
Never heard. Well, just as well, because Vietnam, we would have been sent to Vietnam, I think. You probably would have been a major or a colonel.
Because that was all before Gordon's time. He wasn't. He was only a boy then.
Mm.
He'd be at Lindisfarne then, I think.
Yes.
It was about 19. He'd been in over 30 years now. 19, oh, I can't remember, mid-70s Vietnam. He didn't go into the army until the mid-80s.
Oh, yes.
Well,
just coming back to complete the story, your wife passed away four years ago. Mm. So you'd been married for how many
years? 55 years.
55 years. Yes, that's a big break, isn't it? Yes.
Yeah, we were married for 55 years. And had two children. My wife was fortunate in that she's able to get a number of trips home, I think. In those 55 years, she had about 6 or 7 trips home.
Mm-hmm.
She's well qualified. She trained at the Royal Infirmary in Edinburgh as a general nurse.
Mm-hmm.
She's then trained as a specialist nurse in fever nursing, at sanitariums, that sort of thing. And then she went to London, where she trained as a midwife.
Mm.
And she's a midwife. You know that program on TV, where they get around their bicycles? That's exactly what she did.
Did she really?
And she said the most important thing was, before you went out, you made sure you had plenty of pennies, because you'd have to use, you might have to use a telephone. Public telephone. She used to tell some great stories about that.
Yes. So,
and when she came back, when she came to New Zealand, she came out under her sister, £10 pom, was it? And she was sent to Pathé, you see?
Right.
So, a little while later, here I was there with appendicitis.
Yes. So I always remember Pathé, the canoe.
Yeah, that's right. Turi's canoe.
It's the memorial.
And there were two social functions in Pathé per annum.
Yes.
The two big social functions were the nurses' ball and the RSA ball. One was in May and one was in June.
Yes.
So I took her to both.
Right. Well.
And my parents were home then in England, and they always called it home.
Mm.
And they were able to meet her family.
Oh, that's lovely.
So, and then somebody offered us a house, or somebody offered us to live in part of their house. So we decided to get married. And that's all happened.
Mm. Well, you know, Bruce, that's a really wonderful story from Bigglesworth. Bigglesworth in England, was that the name of the place you...
What?
Bigglesworth?
Giggleswick.
Oh, Giggleswick. From there to here, that's a really great story. Giggleswick.
That's the village cross, and this is the lynch gate into the church. Black Horse, the hotel, is just off. These are all old pictures. It's all about the parish, which includes Lancliffe.
Yes, sure.
There is a picture somewhere, I think, of where you can see part of it.
And they always found themselves on the edge of a stream, didn't they? You'd wonder how they'd get a name like Giggleswick, wouldn't you?
Yeah, well, I've got another book here somewhere. It tells how the name was derived. Yeah, there's the cross again.
Oh, yes.
And the black horse is just over here. Well, there. That's the entrance of the church.
Right. Carved by the lich gate covering the barrels to the Black Horse Hotel.
Giggleswick is renowned for its public school.
Yes.
And that's the school register going back, as Jenkinson mentioned. See, Dad's written in a lot of stuff. Ah, there's one. George. George was his second brother. So Dad will come further over somewhere. He'd be after him. January 1895. So many of these fellows died in the First World War. There, that's the father there. That's the school register.
Thank you, Bruce, for this.